Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Dan Coppell. Dan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited because you are the first person I have had on the podcast who has a direct relationship with Star Trek, but I don't want to jump ahead, so why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am a writer. I live in Los Angeles. I work mostly as a journalist. I'm probably best known for writing what many people believe is the definitive book on the history of the banana. But very early in my career, in the 90s, I got the opportunity to write an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, which was an incredible experience and sort of my true claim to fame.
I know this is a Star Trek podcast, but before we get to that, bananas are a very interesting thing, right? Because, and now tell me if I'm wrong, but there used to be like hundreds of species of bananas, right? And now there's only like one that's the hugely popular one. Is that right?
Right. Well, there are still over 1,000 varieties of banana grown worldwide, but the only banana fundamentally that we get as an import banana is the Cavendish banana. It's the one that everybody gets in the store, and it is the worst banana you can eat, and it's caused huge social, environmental, political, and economic problems over the years.
And I was going to say, I've heard that that is, in fact, the worst-tasting banana there is, so... But I guess it's hardy enough to travel. Is that the idea?
Right. It's so bad that in India, for example, where they grow 600 varieties of banana and where the best bananas are found, they call the Cavendish the hotel banana because it's only served to people who are white who live in hotels.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But, the other ones are way, way better and more delicious.
And I have one more banana question for you, and then we can talk about Star Trek.
Sure.
Just because I do think bananas are fascinating. So I'll have to read your book. Am I right? I've heard somewhere that they are shipped in giant cargo ships, right? But they have to be filled with like nitrogen or something because they can't ripen while they're shipping or something like that.
Right. I mean, if you think about bananas, they're really an impossible fruit. The way we get them, they're the cheapest fruit in the supermarket, yet they're very perishable. They're shipped great distances. They cost way more than apples do, which are grown in most U.S. states. And one of the ways they do that is by shipping them in these containers that are pumped full of something called ethylene gas, which is a gas that delays ripening.
Fascinating. But enough banana talk. But for me, I was very interested in that, so thank you for that. Let's talk about a little bit of Star Trek here. Now you've written an episode of Star Trek, Inheritance, which is actually, by odd coincidence, an episode that we have covered on Random Trek, episode 33, if you want to listen to that. Luckily, I like that episode, so I didn't say anything too bad about it, I don't think.
No, you guys were pretty good.
This would be a much more awkward episode of Random Trek if I had mocked it mercilessly, but I think it's a good episode. So let's talk a little bit. So I know I ask people, are you a Star Trek fan? I'm pretty sure you're a Star Trek fan, but I'm going to ask anyway. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, I am. I'm 53. I grew up with the original series. I grew up imagining and believing that either Captain Kirk or Mr. Spock, depending on my mood, would come to my house and adopt me and take me away. I really love that show.
Who would be the better father, Captain Kirk or Spock? Now, Captain Kirk's son dies by Klingon, so
that's not a good
track record.
That's later on, but by the time I got to be 10, I was clearly in the Spock camp. There's no question about it.
I feel like Spock would be loving but distant as a father.
Just like my real dad. So there we are.
Well, there you go. So would you say that the original series is your favorite Star Trek series?
You know, it was not just my favorite series. It was the only series I knew about, even as Next Generation began in the 1990s. I was working as a journalist and I knew there was a new Star Trek series, but had never seen it. And it was only when I had the opportunity to possibly write for Star Trek that I began to watch TNG and really came to love it a lot. I have to say that the original series remains my favorite, but TNG, I have a lot of affection for that.
So let's talk about how you came to write an episode of Star Trek. The Next Generation. You only wrote, you wrote one episode, a standalone episode. So how did that happen?
Well, it's I'll try and make it brief because it's kind of a funny story, but it's a long story. But you know, I did love Star Trek as a teenager. When I was 14, I went to high school wearing my Vulcan ears, thinking that would help me get girls. So I it didn't, but it cemented my reputation. And so I was always a big Star Trek fan, and I was working in Los Angeles, which is where they film it, at a business magazine, and one of my close friends is a television writer. He didn't write for Star Trek, but one of his buddies did. And I was at a cocktail party. This writer was Joe Minoski, who wrote a lot of episodes of TNG. Mm-hmm. And I said, God, I love Star Trek so much. You know, it's really like, and I told him, I wore Vulcan ears to school. And he's like, well, you should, you're a writer. Why don't you come and pitch some story ideas to us? And I was like, are you kidding? I'm not a screenwriter. I'm a journalist. He's like, well, just if you want to, you're welcome to. So they sent me their story guide, and for the next 2 years, I spent all my time watching TNG and coming up with hundreds and hundreds of story ideas. And every few months, I would go to Paramount, meet with these guys, and bomb terribly. They kept asking me back. Probably, maybe they saw something that they liked, but I was incapable of telling a story briefly, as I am right now, as this interview proves. And I just didn't get it. So I wasn't selling.
How does one, now I am not someone who has ever written for television. This podcast has made me think about Star Trek as a TV series, and as a kind of like a thing that gets made, which I know sounds crazy. But when I'm watching it, it's just kind of like, oh look, I'm watching my TV friends. And I don't think about the fact that, writers and producers and directors are all involved. I know they're not real people. I know this is fiction, so I know it all happens, but it's not something I think about as I'm watching it. So I have no real insight into how this is made. So how is that kind of pitch meeting set up? Is it just like in the movies, like you're sitting in a chair by yourself and there's like a table full of people who are judging you and you're sweating and you're trying to do things, or what how does that happen?
You must have been there. Yeah. That's exactly the way it is. It's a horrific experience. I would go in and they give you a writer's guide. It gives you a list of the rules of what you can and can't do, what they're looking for, what they're not. And you go in with three or four ideas, you try and get them interested. So at first I would give them these incredibly detailed, like 3-page ideas that I would read out, top to bottom. By the time I sold one, I knew, don't give them anything. Just come up with like the TV guide blurb of what happens and then get them to talk. And I knew that if you got them talking about it and interested and developing the story with you on the spot, then you were going to sell it. Uh-huh. At first it was just horrible. I mean, I would sweat. It was the flop sweat was just like dripping from me. It was so much that I remember I made a big show of like mopping my brow, because I figured if you're going to like be covered in sweat, you should at least like pretend like it's okay and not pretend to hide it.
I'm normally very sweaty. This is normal. Don't worry.
Me too. Yeah. So it was really, I mean, kind of an amazing evolution in education in storytelling. So by the time I sold my episode, I was down to, just giving them 3 sentences about each one and being very strategic about it and making sure that if they didn't like what I did, at least it didn't last very long and they'd ask me back.
That's how I do many things in my life.
Yeah.
Do you remember the 3-sentence pitch for Inheritance?
I do. And so the thing about Inheritance was, it was funny because, the writer's guide lists the rules that you have to obey. And especially for like a newcomer, a freelancer, they basically tell you, you break a rule and you're never being asked here again. Two of the rules were never introduce a relative. You're not allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. And there are no other androids in the universe but Data. So when I was thinking, I pitched them 7 or 8 times maybe, and I was thinking about this stuff, and I had this idea that Data has a mom, And I was like, that's not going to work. And then I thought, I don't know how it came about, but it was sort of like, well, what if she's an android and she doesn't know it and he has to tell her? And that became the fundamental pitch. Data finds out he has a mom. Turns out she's an android. She doesn't know it. And he has to decide whether to tell her. That was the whole pitch. That was all I came up with at that point. And it was funny because I remember being in my apartment and thinking to myself, this is going to work. They're going to buy this. I know they are. But it broke two rules. And so, you know, I was afraid. And so I came up with sort of a manipulative strategy to be able to introduce a pitch that broke a couple of rules. Mm-hmm. And I could tell you what it is if you want.
I want to hear what it is.
So I came, every time I pitched at that point, I had it down, it would be four or five ideas. I had four or five ideas, but I didn't care about the other ones. I don't know why, but I just knew that Inheritance would sell the way I pitched it. So I gave them my three sort of not good ideas, and I made sure they were very fast. I made sure that I was a little bit funny. And then they said, do you have anything else? And I said, you know, I normally give you four ideas, but I have one, but God, it breaks a couple of the rules, and I don't want to do that, you know, because I know you don't want me to do that. And they were like, oh no, it's fine. Go ahead. And that's what I'd planned the whole time. And so they said, go ahead. And I told them just what I told you. And the looks on their faces, it was obvious they wanted it. They were like, sold. And I knew it was going to, I mean, just for some reason, I was very confident. I knew it. And they sent me home, and said, okay, now, you know, we talked about it. Now come up with the story. But the pitch was really simple, really basic. And the idea was to get them talking about it and to let me break the rules. Now, I know in season seven, they introduced tons of relatives. So it was kind of like family reunion season for Star Trek. I didn't know that at the time because season seven hadn't been filmed yet. And I didn't know what else they were doing.
Right. All bets were off in season seven. They're like, yeah. Everybody's an android. Everybody's relatives show up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all relatives, all androids. That's what season seven is known for. So I know we're going to talk about a Voyager episode, but I want to talk a little bit more about this episode. Because honestly, your episode is much better than the Voyager episode that we watched, which I will say, because it's not a surprise now, is Time and Again, season one, episode four. The name of a book that is also much better than this episode. Always tricky to name your episode after a book that is a classic, but
always a bad idea.
It is. Well, that's a question I have for you. You wrote this episode, not this episode, Inheritance. Do you come up with the titles? How do the titles work? I have no idea how these things work.
I did come up with that title. I can't say that that's always the case. I wrote the story for the episode, and then, as with all new writers, they assign you to a staff writer, and I was lucky enough to get assigned to Renee Echevarria. And so we wrote the teleplay together. So if you look at it, I get the story credit and half the screenplay credit.
Uh-huh.
But I did come up with the name, and a lot of the fundamental character stuff was mine. I think Renee added a lot of the sort of, plot hooks and things that got us to that point where Data has to decide whether or not to tell Juliana Sum that she's an android.
Mm. Now, as a writer, were you on set at all when they were filming it? Does that happen? I don't know anything about this. So,
being a writer, I mean, it's sort of not cool or unprofessional to be such a total fanboy. But being a total fanboy, I did not wear my Star Trek uniform, but I did beg to be let on the set one day. And it was actually pretty funny because they were like, okay, you can come on the set just for half an hour and check it out. And of course, they were really busy, but I was introduced to Brent Spiner, who turns out is a practical joker. He comes up to me and says, who are you? And I tell him, and he goes, well, you know, do you know what's going on with this episode? And I said, no, what's going on? He says, well, they took your name off it. And I'm like, what? Why? And I was literally like on the verge of tears. And then he kind of relented and told me it was a practical joke. And I was like, haha, that's funny. So yeah, I was on the set, much to my chagrin.
Oh dear. Yeah. So then your dreams were crushed.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have one final question about this, and then we can move on to Voyager. Actually, there's a bridge there, so we'll talk about that as well. But so how does it feel being a fan of Star Trek and then writing lines that you see these characters that you are a fan of saying? I mean, it must be kind of a little surreal.
Well, it was great. I mean, it was so much fun, you know. And you know, Star Trek has had in the TV series, not the original, but in all the subsequent ones, had a tradition of letting fans pitch stories. Mm-hmm. Now, generally, that didn't mean fans could come in and pitch and over and over again. And I think the fact that I was some kind of professional writer, let them, you know, allowed me to keep coming in. But basically, it was just the greatest thing. And yet at the same time, being like an already published author who, you know, with some experience, I think I handled it pretty professionally. You know, the biggest shock, I think, was something I realized then, and is still true today, which is, I mean, then I'd probably written 200-300 magazine and newspaper articles. These days, it's 4 books, you know, thousands of magazine articles. Mm-hmm. And I can still say that to this day, if you look at the number of people who saw my Star Trek episode, that very first night only, let alone reruns, that's more than everybody who's ever read anything else I've ever written all put together. So you know, I know where the high point of my career lies, and it's deep in the past at this point.
But what a high point it is.
It was great. It was awesome.
This is it's craziness.
Yeah, a dream come true. I mean, absolutely a dream come true. I'm so lucky to have been able to do that.
Now, I know that because of the strength of your script, you were offered an interesting job that ties in with the episode that we watched for Voyager. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Right. So I'm not sure how, you know, how exclusive this was, but I think it was fairly uncommon. They were in the last season of Next Generation, and were Deep Space Nine was going on, but they were starting up Voyager, and I was asked to be one of the people who submitted pitches, and potentially would be hired as a staff writer, for the first season of Voyager. And so I got very early on the Voyager Writer's Guides, probably before most people, a couple of years before most people had seen them, and did come up with quite a few Voyager pitches, but only went in and pitched once, because other career opportunities and other writing jobs, which were not Star Trek related, which were way less lucrative, appealed to me at the time. And so it was around that time that I became sort of a globe-trotting travel writer, you know, banana exploring kind of guy, and chose sort of real science writing over science fiction, you know, much to the chagrin of my bank account forever, I'd say. But there was something about Voyager I didn't really like so much. I don't know what it was. It didn't feel totally Star Trek-y to me, I guess.
Interesting.
And I can't say what that was, but I didn't feel super inspired the way I did with Next Generation.
Well, that must be difficult. I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but obviously that you were extended this offer to pitch before you had seen any Voyager, because there was no Voyager. They had the rules and the characters and stuff, I'm sure, but there was nothing to see. So it must be more difficult to get excited to write for a show that you have seen nothing of. Whereas with The Next Generation, you saw a few seasons of it, you kind of knew what was going on with it, so it could be a little easier, I guess. I don't know. Or harder, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the guide was pretty established. I mean, I think it was harder, but it was also pretty exciting. I mean, I'm looking at, like, some of my original Voyager notes, and, like, I have a whole, like, 6-page document that lists in alphabetical order different alien races we could introduce. You know, so there was something kind of fun about it, and about the way it was all new and all fresh. But it wasn't quite enough. In a way, it was like I'd done the Star Trek, and it was so great, and I didn't want it to be my job. I'm also more, as a writer, more of a loner. I like to work by myself, and television is extremely collaborative. And though I loved being in the room for the 2 or 3 weeks that we all hashed out the inheritance, I kind of knew that it wasn't sort of suiting my particular personality as a writer.
Well, I think that's fair. But you missed out on the opportunity to write an episode in which time travel is used.
Right.
Which just happens in this episode that we watched time and again, which I will give a very brief synopsis of, because it is not a super complicated episode. And then we could just talk about Voyager in general, I think. Okay, so this episode, time and again, time travel, always exciting. But like I alluded to, there's a famous book, Time and Again, by Jack Finney, which is, I think, one of the definitive time travel books. It's one of my wife's favorite books. It's one of my, I would say, top 100 books, maybe, that I've read. It's a good book. It has an interesting take on time travel. But it is not related to this at all, except that they share the same title. So Voyager comes across this planet. They're using this planet that has had some kind of giant catastrophe. Kes has a vision that this has happened. They beep down. They're like, oh no, what's happened? Subspace is shattered. Tom Paris gets shifted back in time a day. And then Janeway gets shifted back in time a day. They figure out that this planet is using some kind of crazy energy that is vulnerable to exploding a lot. And then through some hijinks, they figure out what happened. And it turns out that the Voyager crew, in trying to save Janeway from being stranded in a day past, actually causes the giant explosion that they come upon. And when Janeway figures that out, she stops it, and everybody goes home. The time is reset. This episode never happens. They skim past the planet that is not destroyed, and everybody's happy. That's a very high-level synopsis of this episode.
Sounds good to me.
Now, one thing that I always notice in early seasons of Voyager is how much it looks like The Next Generation. Especially when they beam down to planets, or in this case, like phase in through temporal shenanigans. It's always that same kind of courtyard, and there's a fountain, and everything's pastels. It's super Next Generation.
Yeah, there's that whole sort of like futuristic look that you see in so many things where it's a, you know, the future looks like a really crappy, dirty shopping mall, or like the courtyard of a hospital or something.
Yeah, it's very strange.
I hate that future.
I don't want to live in that future, but I assume it's an easy set to build, and so that's why they do it. Or maybe they just keep using the same set over and over again.
Probably already existed.
And the other thing that everybody on this planet wears girdles, seemingly. It's a very strange fashion choice. And a lot of banding, although I think color blocking is what the kids call it now, where you wear solid colors and stripes. So this is a very fashion-forward planet, kids.
Yeah, I mean, they look a little bit like they're wearing, like, MC Hammer's rejects and those or it looks like hospital scrubs that have been, like, sewed together from different colors. When I saw it last night, it was easily struck me, and this is saying a lot, as the most horribly visually oppressive costume I've ever seen on any Star Trek episode. That's really saying a lot.
It is a pretty bad costume choice. Although they did interesting, so through some, you know, shenanigans, some weapons are involved, and these people on this planet, who I'm not even going to bother looking up what the planet's called because it doesn't really matter, have guns that look like guns. And that was surprising to me because, you know, there's always phasers or there's always some kind of sci-fi bent to it, but they look like handguns.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I tried to remember if you ever saw any traditional handguns in Next Generation. I probably did, but I couldn't remember. But, you know, there are a couple of famous original series episodes where they go back and fight with gangsters and stuff like that. But it was kind of jarring to see those handguns, and it made me think, gosh, they must have got something out of the Paramount property room. It might have been better to have something that looked a little bit less like that.
Yeah, they should have, like, glued something onto it or something. I don't know. But they don't shoot bullets. It wasn't clear. Tom Paris does get shot.
Yeah, and survives. With medical care, so that's good.
That's right. Although Tom Paris, not one of my favorite Voyager characters, and the kind of the opening scene of this episode is between Tom Paris and Harry Kim, both of which Harry Kim is not in this episode very much. I don't care for Harry Kim, but that's another topic. And Tom Paris basically is like, "Hey, Harry Kim, let's go hit on these twin sisters before somebody else gets to them." And Harry Kim's like, "I have a girlfriend." And Tom Paris is like, "She's light years away. You'll never see her again. So get a move on it."
Yeah, this whole business with the Delaney twins, you know, it struck me as something out of a 70s sitcom. You know, like, are they really? I mean, aren't they supposed to be enlightened? I mean, you know, there needs to be a prime directive about being offensive toward the Delaney twins and everybody else, because it was really jarringly upsetting, especially given that Voyager is crewed by a female, you know, feminist captain.
That's true. It was kind of almost something out of right out of Three's Company. Lieutenant Jack Tripper goes down to the Regal Beagle and tries to get the Delaney sisters.
Yeah, I mean they chase the sisters around a sofa in some lounge or something.
That's right. And then Captain Janeway comes in and everybody hides. And end scene. So let's talk about Captain Janeway, because I feel like, let's talk a little bit about your general experience and exposure to Voyager. Because when Voyager first came on, I was excited because it's a new Star Trek. Always an exciting thing. It didn't really hook me. The first season, I feel like, in many Star Trek series is rocky. So I kind of gave up on Voyager. So I've seen a lot of these episodes for the first time again. What was your experience with Voyager?
Well, I didn't watch a lot of Voyager, and it was partially because, as I said earlier, like I had just started a new job, and I was traveling around the world for most of the mid to late 90s and 2000s. I was on the road 8 to 10 months a year, and you know, there wasn't a lot of syndication of Star Trek in English in the places I was going. So Voyager, you know, I kind of fell off the wagon a little bit. And so I hadn't seen it consistently at all. I liked Enterprise, and I watched that a little bit more. But, you know, I sort of was cruising on Star Trek and watching the original series in TNG on bootleg Chinese DVDs that I bought in Beijing on my laptop. And that was my Star Trek for most of that era. And it wasn't until the new movie came out that I sort of reengaged, on my sofa, let's say.
So what do you think of Captain Janeway as a character? So she's the first female captain, who is helming a TV show. There have been other female characters, or captains, I should say, and admirals and what have you. But she is the main woman captain. Big deal when it first came out. I think it colored a lot of people's perception of the show because there's a woman in charge and people are like, whatever. And for some reason, they decided to give her this weird bun hairdo. I don't understand that either. But so what do you think of Janeway?
Well, the sort of performance, the bun hairdo, the channeling Katharine Hepburn in a way, the way it always felt to me, seemed a little bit off. But I also think there was a structural issue. And I remember someone telling me this when I was pitching Next Generation, that the reason they made Picard so cerebral and not macho and Riker so macho was because Roddenberry never wanted to create the monster that William Shatner became again. And so they split the character. And I think in a way you see that a little bit with Sisko, and you know, it's sort of a not all powerful captain, and you see it a little bit with Janeway also. The casting of the captains becomes sort of a let's not create a Kirk. And the truth is, I think we want a strong captain, especially in the, you know, lost ship, E.T., phone home, Gilligan's Island motif that you see Voyager in. I mean, you need the skipper to be the skipper. And I think, I'm just guessing dramatically, there was some kind of conflict with that, and they never really let that character inhabit or the role the way it should.
And I think that there is, I like Voyager, I've never... Voyager's never been my favorite Star Trek series. It's not my least favorite, which is Enterprise, and I heard you liked Enterprise, so maybe we'll talk about Enterprise a little bit. But I feel like Captain Janeway, as a character, was let down by the supporting characters in many regards, because they're just not as strong as the Next Generation or the original series supporting characters. There are a few that are standouts, but in general, I feel like they're not that great.
Yeah, it's pretty weird and weak that they assimilate these rebels and then suddenly it's mostly peace in the valley. Why not use that conflict as a means of making every episode dramatic? It would have been great. I don't understand why that never happened.
That is my major complaint. I have two major complaints with Voyager, because I think it's a great idea for a Star Trek series, and I do like Captain Janeway a lot. But I feel like they missed two giant opportunities, and I don't know why they did this. The one is the crew and the two crews and the tension that obviously should be there, but is like after the season premiere. This is the fourth episode. Hardly any tension at all between the two crews in this, which is weird. The other one is, so they're stranded. They have no way to repair themselves or anything like that. And the ship never really breaks down.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always kind of pristine, this clean Starfleet thing forever. And I thought it would be much more interesting if they had to show the struggles of this ship, and it, you know, it gets a little grimy over the course of the seasons, but that doesn't really happen. They have certain episodes. A two-parter, Year of Hell, is a fantastic two-parter of Voyager that shows this, but they never did it throughout the whole series. I feel like if they did it throughout the whole series, it would be much more interesting.
Yeah, instead there is this sort of, I mean, I say as a joke, but this Gilligan's Island feel of constantly, you know, finding the way home and then losing it, or you know, it sort of didn't become, it would have been great if Voyager had been a ship that was constantly falling apart, where mm-hmm. there was constant conflict. But, you know, that's not the sort of utopian, feel good 1990s Britney Spears era Star Trek that was.
That's true. And I realize that we're describing Battlestar Galactica, the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. So there you go. Ron Moore went off to do that because he probably couldn't do what he wanted to do in Star Trek. Although Deep Space Nine is a little darker than all the others, literally and figuratively, because it's very dark on Deep Space Nine.
and you know, it's funny, when I was talking to them about writing for Voyager, I remember being told that Voyager was going to be grittier, it was going to be more back to basics, and I think a lot of that came out and then was replaced into Enterprise. When I heard the descriptions of Enterprise the first time, I remember thinking, wow, this really sounds like what they had hoped Voyager would be to some extent, and it never became that, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know. They went a different direction, which I think was not the greatest choice. It feels a little bit to me like a pale echo of The Next Generation.
Yeah.
When I think it could have been a very interesting thing of its own.
Right. But. It's like, you know, DC's Legion of Superheroes. They always had the Legion of Substitute Heroes, who were the heroes who never had good enough powers to get in. This was kind of like the Star Trek equivalent of that.
That is true. Although we emailed back and forth, and I think we both agree, one of our favorite characters that we should talk about now, because we're being down on Voyager. This episode is not a great Voyager episode, but there are some good moments in it. And one of the best moments belongs, as it often does in Voyager episodes, to the Doctor, who is a holographic Doctor, if you're unfamiliar with Voyager, although while you're listening to this, I don't know. And he has this, or Kes is having these weird flashbacks, and she doesn't know what it is. Also, Kes, not a big fan of her. I'm not a big fan of Neelix either. But so the Doctor, they go to the Doctor, and he's like, I don't have your brain scan. And she's like, oh, I just joined the crew. And he's like, nobody told me. And I don't even know what kind of species you are. And she's like, well, how am I? And he says, well, you're the healthiest member of your species I've ever seen. And she's like, oh, great. And he's like, I drink fluids. And she's why? And he's like, well, everyone should drink a lot of fluids.
Yeah, and that, you know, that whole exchange really is odd because, again, it's sort of a, you know, Janeway feminist theme, but Neelix is so dismissive of Kes's emerging psychic abilities. He's a total ass, actually.
He is.
You know, but then, you know, we get to the Doctor, and you really, like, to me, there's two things going on there, one of which, Star Trek is always at its best when you have a sort of character that's not supposed to be human exploring humanity, whether it's Spock or Data or the holographic Doctor. And then it's just Robert Picardo's acting. It's just really head and shoulders above everybody else. He really inhabits that role, makes it work, and you love seeing him on screen, and that's a great thing.
Yes, and he's fun, and that helps a lot. And he has that kind of what you said, I think you said it perfectly, so I'm not going to repeat it. And the other, much later in Voyager's journey, they add another character, Seven of Nine, who is very similar path to the Doctor in that she was a human, but that then she's a Borg, and so trying to find her human roots again. She and the Doctor actually bond, and they have a lot of great chemistry, and that relationship is fantastic. And also, once Seven of Nine joins Voyager, I feel like Captain Janeway then has someone who she can kind of bounce off of as well, as a much better fleshed out character, than the character she was surrounded with. Because there's only so many scenes where she can go talk to the holographic doctor.
Right. Yeah, it's a pretty weak, I mean, for a crew full of rebels and misfits, it's a pretty weak, generic, bunch of people. There's nobody really for like you said, for Janeway to sort of react to.
No, there's Chakotay, who I don't think does anything in this episode. Her first officer, who was the leader of the opposing group, but he joins up. Tom Paris, who we've talked about before, just wants to hit on these random sisters. Harry Kim, who does nothing. I don't like him. Tuvok, who I kind of like, but they never really do anything with Tuvok. So, and in this episode, basically Tuvok's role is to disagree with the plan of trying to rescue Janeway, because he's like, Captain Janeway would never do that. That breaks the Prime Directive, blah, blah, blah. Although she did it, obviously.
Yeah.
So Tuvok doesn't have much to it. B'Elanna Torres is in this episode, but basically she just sets up equipment, so she doesn't have much to do. This episode is really Janeway and Tom Paris. And Tom Paris really doesn't do much.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel for the Tuvok and B'Elanna characters. I mean, in my episode, as you guys point out, there's a lot of talking, a lot of explaining, a lot of backstory, a lot of exposition. You almost have to do that to get the science fiction principle established. Mm-hmm. You don't want to, but you know, you've got so many masters you're serving in a way, so many needs you're serving as a writer, and so you know, ranging from this character needs more screen time to this needs to be explained. And so, they kind of become, holograms, talking holograms themselves, in a way.
The emergency story holograms, right?
Yeah.
Or plot exposition.
Right.
No, I understand that, because, I mean, you know, you also have, you're dealing not only with limits of character and story, right? But you also have a very definite time limit, right? So you have to get, and I don't know how you can possibly figure out how long a story is going to take, like a script is going to take. I have no idea. There must be a dark art to that, because there is like a definitive time limit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're short or long, I think both are probably bad. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. But I did like I love time travel stories. Again, mm-hmm. That's one of the things that's on the no-go list for freelance Star Trek writers. You can't do that.
Oh.
But you know, when I watched this last night, I was thinking, oh man, they're really blowing the time travel story. They're not thinking about the paradox. But in the end, they did. And it's sort of like a great send up of the so-called Hitler paradox, which is, you know, go back, if you went back in time and met Hitler, would you kill him? They go back in time and pretty much find out that they're Hitler. They destroy the universe. And I like that. You know, I thought the episode picked up a lot towards the end, mm-hmm. as that problem became the, gee whiz, let's think about this with the audience problem, which to me is the mark of successful science fiction, when you get the audience sort of playing the what-if game along with the characters. So I think, you know, it starts pretty badly with the Delaney twins and ends pretty badly with the Delaney twins, but
yes,
but it works out pretty well in the middle, I think.
Although it's bookend by the twins, so one on both sides. So there's a little poetic structure there. The other thing that is always dangerous, I think, is when you have a child actor involved.
Yes.
And there is a kid who sees Janeway and Paris kind of temporarily phase into the village square, and he screams, and some random cop comes over and is like, what's going on? And he's like, they weren't there before. And he, you know, makes it his mission to figure out who these people are, and because no one believes him. And then, you know, it's basically like Cousin Oliver from the Brady Bunch, but only in this episode. And
except he's not, because Cousin Oliver is like an old school child actor. He's like kind of interesting looking, and this kid is from the 90s when all the child actors looked like they belonged on the set of a Disney cartoon, and like all knew how to hip hop dance the same way, and he just wasn't like, he wasn't a compelling child character.
No.
You know, even when he's nursing poor Tom Paris after, you know, Paris is a bit shot with that random gun.
Yes, that's true. Although I don't like Tom Paris all that much, but I did like the scene in which the kid is like, what are you going to do to me? And Tom Paris says something along the lines of, well, we eat children. And the kid is like, and he runs away. And I thought, well, that's good.
Yeah.
Good job, Tom Paris. Yeah. That kid is annoying. And then, of course, Tom Paris tries to sacrifice himself to save the kid from being shot. So I guess good job there, too. But
yeah.
Well, I think that we've spoken all we can about this episode, time and again. My recommendation to people listening, if you want to consume some media named Time and Again, look for the Jack Finney book, because it is better than this episode. Although, like Dan, like you said, I think that it is the ending, makes it much more interesting, although I'm not sure it's worth the journey to get to that ending.
Yeah, it's such a generic Star Trek episode, though, that if you don't like the Voyager characters, just sort of fantasize in your own particular favorite Star Trek characters, and it still works exactly the same.
That's true. It could have been on any series whatsoever. Yeah, it really could have. Doesn't rely on any particular character traits.
Even the animated cartoon.
That's right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining me and talking about Bananas and the episode of Inheritance that you wrote, and even this episode of Voyager.
Thank you so much. It was fun to do it.
Next on Random Trek, another Voyager episode. This episode's from Season 3, Distant Origin.